Welcome to the Fitness and Lifestyle Podcast. I'm your host, Danny Kennedy, and I'm here to help you become the very best version of yourself. What is up, guys? Welcome back to the Fitness and Lifestyle Podcast. This week's episode is an absolute cracker. I'm joined by the author of The Proof is in the Plants, Simon Hill. He's a podcast host himself. He's a nutritionist and he's also a physiotherapist. He's a very knowledgeable human being and I thoroughly enjoyed today's chat. We dive into detail about what it means to eat a plant-based diet. I get an understanding of as to why Simon went plant-based in the first place. He shares his story, which is super interesting. And I think you guys are going to take a lot of value away from today's episode. We also cover the misconceptions around what it means to eat a plant-based diet, the benefits, how we can integrate it in our day-to-day nutritional intake. Again, you're going to take a lot away from this episode. So if you do, please do take a screenshot and post it on your Instagram story for me. Tag myself and tag Simon as well. I'll have the link to his social media and also a link to where you can purchase his book. A big thank you for tuning in and I'm really looking forward to bringing you this episode. So I hope you guys enjoy. Simon, welcome to the Fitness and Lifestyle Podcast, man. It's a pleasure to have you on. I'm really excited for today.
Danny, thank you so much for having me. A big, big fan of everything that you do. An OG on the podcast, I would say. So you're a big inspiration to me. So long time coming, I think, for us to connect. And as I was just saying before, I'd love to have you on my show at some time too.
Much appreciated, man. I really do appreciate that. Once we locked in this time slot and the date for the party, I've been kind of sitting down and really having to think about what I'd like to touch on today. And not only just for myself, but probably more so for the listeners, to be honest, because I know, you know, the plant-based diet is such a popular topic at the moment, but I think it's more so just misunderstood, which is why a lot of people struggle to understand why people eat plant-based, the benefits of it. There's a lot of misconceptions out there, which I'm also not 100% aware of as well. So I think everyone's going to get a lot out of today, man. So let's kick things off, mate, with I'd love for you to share with the listeners a bit about yourself and in particular, why you went plant-based in the first place.
Sure. So a little quick preview into what I do. I have a master's in nutrition and a bachelor's degree in physiotherapy. So I started off as a physiotherapist and then found my way into the world of nutrition. And for me, Danny, my interest in nutrition really stems back to my childhood. So my dad is a researcher and he researches cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes, really looking at risk factors and mechanism level under the microscope, mm-hmm. You know, hardcore proper science.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so for as long as I can remember, I grew up in Melbourne and we lived in Eltham in the sort of northeast. And for as long as I can remember coming home, I would always see piles and piles of scientific studies. And if I hopped in dad's car, he's picking me up from school or something, I'd usually have to move a big pile of them off the seat just to get in. And so science has been something that I've always been around. Mm-hmm. And I've always had an enormous amount of respect for and really appreciated in terms of how it can inform us to make better decisions with our life and to be healthier and happier. And so when I was 15, there was a particular day that really, I guess, planted a seed for me. And
no pun intended.
Yes. My dad and I, so on the weekends, my dad, my brother and I would often go out and explore the Yarra Valley. Yep. And it was a bit of an activity that we'd do on the weekend just to spend some time with dad. And we'd visit different wineries and just have a fun time out there hanging out. And on this one particular day, it was just my brother and I. And we went out and we spent the day together. It was great. My dad had an MGB convertible back then. And that was, you know, it was a spring day. It was sunny, rolling hills. It was beautiful. And we were driving home and I could notice that my dad was experiencing some discomfort and I could see it on his face. He kept sort of grabbing his shoulder. And so I asked him if he was okay. And he said that he was experiencing some chest pain and he reassured me that it was okay. and we proceeded to drive home. And we had a house in Eltham and then also a little bit of a sort of cabin out in King Lake. I'm not sure if you know King Lake.
Don't know the area well, but yeah.
It's like out past Whittlesea.
Okay.
And,
yep.
And so it is remote, and this was, you know, it was in the woods. And so that's where we were staying, and just my dad and I that night, and my mother and brother were staying in Eltham. And so we got back to King Lake and we had dinner, and he reassured me that everything was okay, and that pain didn't seem to escalate. And so we cooked dinner and I headed off to bed. And a few hours later, I heard some cluttering around and enough noise to wake me up. And so I went out to check and see what that noise was and check on him. In the back of my mind, I was remembering that he was experiencing some pain. And so I went out, and by that stage, it was past a point where he could deny it and hide it.
Yeah.
And I could see he was very out of breath. He was pale. And it was probably, to be honest, the first time I'd ever seen my dad have an expression of fear. I could see the fear. I could really sense it.
See the worry.
And yep. I should add, he on this day, he was only 41 years old. And so he wasn't an old guy. He was relatively young. He had two teenage boys, and was a very, very representative of an Australian young father. You know, his health was normal, average, I would say. He wasn't on any medications. He would exercise 3 or 4 times a week. He was probably carrying a little bit of extra weight, but not obese.
Nothing out of the ordinary.
No, like he'd never been diagnosed with any sort of condition or anything like that. He wasn't relying on the healthcare system, and so this was all very unexpected. And he had called 000 and was, you know, clearly had realized by this point he needed some emergency help. And he spoke to them, and by the time I made it out there, they asked if someone else was there to give a sort of more accurate description as to what was happening, which they often do. And I was the only person there. So I detailed to the AMBOs what was happening. And they said, based on where you're located in King Lake, in the closest hospital, we need to send a helicopter. And so it was super fast. A helicopter came. We're very lucky in this country to have this kind of medical service. Helicopter came. Luckily, we had an area at the back where a helicopter could land. They came in, they scooped him up, they put him on oxygen, heart rate monitor, checking all the vital signs. And before I knew it, had stretched him out to the helicopter and said, I couldn't fit, but I could trail in an ambulance by road. And so that was a long, long drive to the hospital for me. And I remember calling my mom and saying, you and my brother James, you better come to the hospital. This is what's happening. And we really don't know the outcome here. And so they did. And we got to the hospital, and there was a long wait. And the doctor came out and he said to us, look, we've saved your father's life. He was having a very serious heart attack. And he'll be on medications for the remainder of his life, probably. But the most important thing is that he's alive. And definitely for us right there and then, that's what we were concerned with.
Yep.
So we were very, you know, very happy and, you know, thankful for that medical care. And the next day, and this is really, I guess, the seed that was planted, was there was a bit of a team meeting with the cardiologist, my brother, myself, and with my mother. And by that time, the cardiologist had taken my dad's history, and he had, his father, my grandfather, had also had a heart attack. And he said to my brother and I, he said, this is the cardiologist. He said, look, you guys are nearly young adults. You'll need to be screened and be careful as you grow up to make sure that you don't have a heart attack as well. Yeah. And that in itself is actually really good advice. It is good advice, but I just wish the conversation had gone further. because for me and my brother for many years, we were left thinking, well, that's our genetic fate. This runs in our family. It's in our DNA. And so we really weren't left wondering what we could do to reduce our risk of having a heart attack. It felt like that was our destiny.
Yeah.
And so, you know, some 10 odd years later and going back to university and studying nutrition at a deeper level, it became very clear to me, and we have some great studies that speak to this, that while our genetics can predispose us to many different types of diseases, that is true. By and large, it's our lifestyles that determine whether those genes are expressed. And the main reason why these chronic diseases, cardiovascular disease, various types of cancer, type 2 diabetes, even dementia, the main reason that these are running in families is because families usually adopt the same lifestyle. And so as I was uncovering this information, it was very empowering for me, first and foremost, and certainly information that I wanted to share with my friends and my family. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, one thing led to another, and eventually it was the inspiration to sort of set up and do everything that I've done and everything that I'm still doing today.
That's incredible. There's always a story behind that driving passion, the driving factor. I was listening to a podcast just the other day with Jay Shetty and Deepak Chopra. And he was talking about very, very similar topic. You know, he's like the top five diseases or something like that. Yes, that there's you've got a predisposed genetic makeup of, you know, the fact that's a likelihood of you getting this disease, but 90% of the likelihood comes from what you do. It's all in your control. It's your lifestyle, it's your environment, it's what you put in your body, it's what you do, you know, the energy expenditure you do with your body. And like you said, I think you use a really good word, empowering. It's incredible to have that knowledge of knowing that it is up to us. Like, yes, there is a certain part of it which is out of our control, and that's just life. But a lot of it is up to us. And that's why, you know, we do things like this podcast and provide content, and ultimately what you're doing with everything that you're doing is to help others understand that and take control. So what was, I guess, the first step for you? Was it in the nutrition side of things, was it then researching a lot about nutrition? Was it a bit of trial and error? Was it, you know, finding that certain foods made you feel better than others? Or was there someone that you looked up to or took advice from to go down the path of a plant-based diet?
Yeah, so should we define plant-based diet? Because I think we should.
Yeah.
That's also, I guess, quite interesting. Because as I was going through the research, like today I eat an exclusively plant-based diet, right? Mm-hmm. But as I was going through the research, I didn't read something and was compelled to do that overnight. That's not how it happened. And a plant-based dietary pattern, if we're talking about how it's used within nutrition science rather than how it maybe is used online and in the media, mm-hmm. Well, it actually encompasses a Mediterranean diet. It encompasses a pescatarian diet, a vegetarian diet.
Yep.
It can encompass a sort of flexitarian diet that's very plant forward, all the way through to a plant exclusive diet. So I think that's important for everyone to understand that plant-based, if we're talking about from a nutrition science point of view, is a bit of an umbrella term, mm-hmm. and different studies are using different types of plant-based dietary patterns.
Okay.
And so at the start, what was really clear to me and is very clear in the nutrition science is that everyone wants this black and white answer. What is the single best diet? And usually what we're trying to do is we're trying to work out the single best diet based on these labels that we've made up.
Yep.
Many of those I just reeled off, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so early on, I was trying to work that out. And it's a valid question that people have, like, what is the healthiest dietary pattern or dietary brand, label, whatever we want to call it. And what became very clear to me was that In fact, science doesn't tell us what is the single most optimal dietary brand. It doesn't, and probably never will. But what it does really shine light on is a set of characteristics or a theme. And that theme became stunningly clear for me, particularly from a cardiovascular disease risk point of view. And that is, you know, diet that is low in saturated fat. It's got a good amount of unsaturated fats. It has a low amount of ultra processed foods. It's rich in fiber and it contains good amounts of plant protein. Now, that actually can be done in a number of different ways. Mm-hmm. And so that can be kind of uncomfortable when people hear that, because we do want the black and white definitive.
I think that's you hit the nail on the head, right? It's like everyone's looking, as you've said, the answer. And then when you say to someone, yeah, this is the answer, but there's a few different answers under that answer, it's like, fuck. Now what?
So I guess the positive is that it means that you have choice. You have choice with underneath this sort of theme. There are different ways of going about it, and that might look a little different from person A to person B, person C. Mm-hmm. Now, what's clear is, though, diets that are plant predominant, where a good amount of the calories are coming from whole plants, what happens is automatically it becomes a diet that's low in saturated fat, it's rich in fiber, it's rich in plant protein. And that's why you see these dietary patterns like a thoughtfully constructed Mediterranean diet or a pescatarian diet or vegetarian diets in the research doing very well quite consistently mm-hmm. in terms of cardiovascular risk, et cetera. So where I was going with this is that's what I discovered early on. And so for me, it was not about some sort of dietary label. It was, okay, well, my current diet, let's look at it. All right, I'm getting almost all of my protein from animal products. I'm not eating actually a whole lot of ultra processed foods. This was at the time. I actually wasn't eating a lot of those foods, but I had very little plant diversity and probably insufficient fiber like most Australians. And so for me, it was nudging in that direction. And what did that look like? Well, that looked like not having so much red meat. It was, instead of it being a daily or a twice daily occurrence, I was bringing in these foods like lentils and tempeh and different types of beans and tofu. And so naturally, as the more of those different little changes I was making, I was nudging my diet towards a higher fiber diet, a diet that was providing more protein from plants and a diet that was lower in saturated fat. So I was ticking all of these boxes. Now, as I was doing that, I was actually feeling the benefits.
Yeah.
And so I was personally feeling little changes in my body, you know, energy, my sleep. I felt one of the biggest things that I felt was, you know, I grew up in Melbourne and have a very close group of guy friends, you know, lads, and you have these big dinners out and boys' dinners out. And we usually would choose steakhouses. And we would go a lot to Squire's Loft in Melbourne. And, you know, I loved those dinners, some of the, you know, best nights out with your friends. And, but I always felt afterwards, I always felt like I just needed to go to sleep straight away. It was very, very tiring for me to digest a huge steak. And it was probably more the size of the steaks there. But one thing I noticed was that as I was eating more of these plants that were rich in plant protein, my digestion felt a little lighter, a little bit more effortless, and I didn't feel like I needed to sort of have a nap after a huge meal. And so it was just these subtle little changes, because I wasn't someone coming into this with health problems. So for me, it was just feeling these little subtle changes in energy and sleep and digestion, and I was just empowered to continue making changes. And also I was getting confidence because I had all of those, you know, very valid questions that most people in my position would have around nutrients and protein. And I'd read the science, but I wanted to see how it felt for me and if it was possible to eat in this way, not just to reduce my risk of chronic disease, but to also feel good and continue to perform and pursue athletic endeavors as well.
Yeah, that leads me on to something that I wanted to ask you is in regards to performance, in regards to, say, building a physique. Obviously, on this podcast, we talk about a range of different things, but a lot of the time the topic is around not only how you feel and how you perform, but also the aesthetic side of things as well. So a question that came up a lot when I posted a story on Instagram yesterday saying that we were going to have a chat was, you know, how do you go about trying to build muscle mass? Is it super difficult to get in enough protein to repair the muscles and to grow when you're in a gaining or massing phase? Like, were these things issues for you early on? And has there been certain, I guess, hacks you could call it that you found over time that helped this process?
Definitely. This is a great question. There's a lot to unpack here. So let's step it out. So I went into this already training and was taking my training relatively seriously. So I really understood my strength capacity. And so I had good sort of baseline understanding of where I was at. And I was worried. I was very worried Yep. about shifting away from animal protein to plant protein. Through my my initial university in physiotherapy, that was when I started working out, surrounded by, you know, just typical gym culture and fitness culture, and then football culture, and everything was centered around animal protein. So that was my background I was coming from. So I definitely feared this transition to plant protein. The first thing that I needed to understand was that I could actually get all of the essential amino acids
Yep.
that my body would need. And to be honest, initially I thought that plants were completely missing certain essential amino acids. And in fact, through my nutrition course, that was actually how it was taught. But it's not actually correct. All plants contain all essential amino acids, but they are in different ratios. And so there are what are known as limiting amino acids. And if we go into the weeds here, you can feel free to pull me out, but I think this is interesting for people to hear. And you've probably covered this stuff on your show before, but a limiting amino acid like lysine, for example, in rice. Mm-hmm. Now, this idea of a limiting amino acid, essentially what it means is that if you were to eat only that food for all of your caloric requirement for the day, mm-hmm. then you would fall short on the adequate amount that your body requires of that essential amino acid. So if you eat, say, 3,000 calories, that's your requirement, and you eat 3,000 calories of brown rice, you're going to fall short on lysine.
Yep.
And that, as a sort of definition, kind of makes sense if we're talking about developing countries and third world countries where perhaps they have very limited food access. Mm-hmm. But if you have just modest amounts of diversity in your diet, that issue goes away straight away.
Yeah.
So, and the other thing is that sometimes it's thought that you need in every single meal, you need to have sort of complementary proteins, but it looks like it's more over a 24-hour period. So the body does have some ability within a 24-hour period to have a pool of these amino acids. And so the diversity that I'm talking about, really that comes down to a daily basis, not a single meal. Mm-hmm. Now, this is sort of deep into, I guess, the weeds. What's probably more important is if we come out and look at science that's comparing someone eating an omnivorous diet versus someone eating a completely plant-based diet, and what are the difference in terms of their outcomes from a strength point of view and hypertrophy. Mm-hmm. And so there's a bunch of research, and you will be well across this, that shows that if we are wanting to optimize strength and hypertrophy, we want to be consuming at least around 1.6 grams per kilogram body weight, sort of as a lower threshold. And there are some nuance to this, I guess, if you're cutting and you're in extreme deficit.
Yeah.
But if we're just talking about the average person here, that's sort of that the threshold. And there was a recent study that did look at exactly this, and they took male adults. These were fit, healthy adults who were doing lots of physical activity, but they weren't strength training athletes. So they were coming into this untrained, which is, I guess, it's important to know. And they this is the first study that's ever matched total protein and compared an omnivorous diet with a completely plant-based diet. And this is important because all of the previous studies, what they've done is they've added, a vegan protein to one group, but their baseline diet was omnivorous. So it's not a true representation of getting all of your protein from plants, whereas this study did that. And
the studies were taking in 1.6 gram per kilo of body weight. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was their target. Both groups ended up at 1.7 when they added up all of the meal intake, the nutrient intake across the study. And they found over the duration of this study, which was a 12-week program. There was a progressive overload training program in there. This study was actually out of Brazil, and they found no differences in lean muscle growth, cross-sectional area, or strength, which was, you know, very, very interesting. But I think it does speak to what are our priorities here? What are the most important things? And I'd be interested to workshop this with you. But I would say, and I still say this to people, number one is your training stimulus.
Mm.
And you've got to send a signal to the body to grow. And I think sometimes we forget that. And then your hitting a protein target and calories is going to be very important. And what this study is speaking to, at least in this population group, who are healthy males, untrained going into it, there was no difference based on the source of the protein as long as the total protein was hitting 1.6 grams. So,
and do you mind me asking what sources, like what actual foods or was it supplements that their plant based group were using?
Great question. So this is something that there's been a lot of commentary about this online. So in both groups, there was a protein shake. In the omnivorous group, it was a whey protein shake. And in the plant-based group, it was a soy isolate. And interestingly, in the omnivorous group, they had 43 grams of plant protein a day, whereas in the plant-based group, they had 60. So they averaged about 17 grams more per day out of protein powder, which probably makes sense. The interesting thing is I would say that the plant-based diet, and I've spoke to the guy that did this study on my podcast, I would say they didn't optimize the baseline diet from a protein point of view. There was no tofu or seitan or tempeh, which are going to be your higher protein per calorie plant foods. Mm-hmm. They were getting their protein from chickpeas and kidney beans and black beans. So I think there would have been room in that study to optimize the diet a little bit to then bring the soy protein shake down if someone wanted to. Mm-hmm. But the study was out of Brazil and they don't have the same food access to some of those higher protein plant foods.
One more thing I was going to ask you with that one was in regards to calorie intake. So the protein intake was set at 1.6 or 1.7 per kilogram of body weight. In regards to calories, were all participants eating in a calorie surplus? Were they at maintenance, or how did that look?
The average was around 3,000 calories.
Okay,
I'm not sure if for the individuals if that was a calorie surplus or a deficit, but there was no significant difference between the calorie intake between groups.
Okay, cool.
And even in saying that, I still, as I mentioned there, I think there would be a way within that plant-based arm, if you wanted to sort of further optimize to drop calories a bit, which is, you know, something that a question I often get is when someone is wanting to keep the protein up, but drop the calories.
Calories, yeah.
What do you do? Yeah.
What do you do? What's the best way to do that? Because I know even going off the clients that I work with on their nutrition, those that do have the itch to go more plant-based often have that, I guess, fear is the word you could use, or worry about how they would be able to stick to their deficit but keep the protein intake high enough.
You need to look to foods like seitan. Protein powder is going to be in there. If you're an athlete and you're trying to do this and manipulate it to be in the calorie deficit, and you're doing it all with plant-based foods and supplements, then protein powder you're going to lean on. Seitan is your highest protein, plant-based protein food per calorie. Mm-hmm. So, and it's also very rich in leucine. We haven't spoken about leucine, but I feel like if someone's going to that length to optimize, they're probably also concerned about leucine and getting enough leucine in their diet to maximize muscle protein synthesis. You're going to shift away a little bit from whole grains, which often people in the plant-based community are eating quite a lot of.
Yep.
You're going to shift away from those, and you will eat more tofu, more tempeh. And I don't mind that, because this person's already going to be consuming a very high fiber diet. So I'm not so worried about the removal of whole grains for someone who has this specific goal. So those are the types of things that I would be manipulating and changing if someone was wanting to go high protein, at least 1.6 grams per kilogram, and trying to bring their calories down.
We're just taking it back a step quickly before we keep moving forward. You mentioned before it's the word plant-based can often be a bit confusing to understand exactly what that means. Like, for your style of eating, is that classified under vegan? Like, are you vegan?
Yeah, so I would be, I don't describe myself as sort of vegan. And yep. I mean, I choose to do that because I just don't like getting involved
in the
diet wars and all of that. And really, my personal decision for consuming a plant exclusive diet is more for environmental reasons than animal welfare reasons than health. It's if those weren't considerations for me, then I would be, quite happily adopting a more plant predominant style diet.
Yeah.
So, and I wrote about that in my book. I think that we don't need to be dogmatic about that. That's a personal decision for me. And it means that I've had to go through these types of optimizations that we're talking about, because it is more challenging. It can't be denied that at 100% plant exclusive, it is more challenging to hit the protein and the calorie goal if you're someone who's trying to really drop body fat and maintain muscle mass.
Yeah. In terms of what you've just touched on, maybe not going all in with the plant-based, so not exclusively plant-based, has there been many or any studies done to show, for example, if I have a client who chooses to go plant-based, say 2 out of their 3 meals a day, or maybe every dinner they eat plant-based. Has there been any studies shown to show the difference or the health benefits that can come from just making switches, not to the whole diet?
Yeah, there's loads. So, I even write about a 2/3 plant-based diet in my book. Firstly, when it gets to a plant predominant sort of dietary pattern, and we're talking 80-85% of calories coming from plants, you're splitting hairs to try and say what is better from a health point of view. It gets to a point of the diet where science can't tease that out. It would really be impossible. We would need to set up a randomized controlled trial from birth, randomize people to these different diets that are all really good versions of that diet, and have those people follow them for the rest of their life. It's going to be impossible. It'll be too expensive and it would take too long. And so that's something that's really important for people to remember. A lot of what we see in science in terms of finding a significant finding, you have to compare two diets that are very different, a standard diet versus a Mediterranean, or a standard diet versus a vegan. But once you get to a point and you start comparing these diets that are very, very similar with just a few differences, you're going to require so many people, and you're going to have to follow them for so long to ever find a difference, if there is any difference.
Yeah.
So it's a great point for someone that doesn't want to go all in. Absolutely, there's huge benefits. If you're shifting, for example, there's a great study, 2019, a researcher called Bergeron, and they set out to look at, it's a funny name, right? they set out, they wanted to look at the difference between red meat, white meat, and legumes.
Yep.
When it comes to cholesterol levels. And so, I mean, and often we hear that white meat is a lot better for health than red meat. And so this was an interesting study. The reason this is interesting is our LDL cholesterol level. We know that we want that to be down at a healthy level for as long as possible. When that's raised, and it's raised over a long period of time, that's what we call the exposure, the total exposure. That's what's increasing our risk. Not by itself, but the main thing that's increasing our risk of what's called atherosclerosis, which is the laying down of the plaque in our arteries.
Okay.
And so the average person in Australia today, Danny, that has an LDL sitting at about 120, 130. You have to get your cholesterol down to about 70, your LDL cholesterol to about 70. That's the point where you're not developing any of this plaque. So when our LDL cholesterol is at that 120, 130, which is the average in Australia, we, underneath the skin in our blood vessels, we are having this plaque. It's bubbling away. It's building. Yes, we don't see the outcome of that usually until we're in our 50s or 60s.
Mm-hmm.
That chronic diseases have long latency periods. You know, might not be showing now, but it's happening.
It's not an overnight thing.
And so here's the thing, coming back to, is this all or nothing, or are there benefits on offer just by making some small changes? So this study showed that there was no difference between red and white meat when it came to cholesterol levels, but there was a significant reduction when people were eating more plant protein from legumes. Okay, so we know that. That's very clear. And that's one of the reasons why these plant-based dietary patterns are so protective. You get a twofold effect. You are reducing these animal foods that increase cholesterol, and at the same time, you're increasing these plant foods that actually have inherent properties, fiber and plant sterols, that drive cholesterol down. Now, a study out of Finland recently, I'm segueing from that study for a reason, because that what they did was they looked at, they compared a diet where 70% of protein was coming from animal protein,
mm-hmm.
to a diet where just 30% of protein was coming from animal protein.
Okay.
So in that diet where just 30% is coming from animal protein, the rest is all coming from plant protein. So these diets are like opposite. And they did find significant decrease in LDL cholesterol. So what we can take away from, and these are just two of many studies, is that as you're shifting and downshifting on red meat and white meat, and you're eating more beans and lentils and tofu and chickpeas, your cholesterol levels will be dropping. They will drop in a matter of weeks, you know, 3 weeks, 6 weeks, 12 weeks. You will see, you can test this on your blood tests, and your risk of cardiovascular disease will be dropping at the same time. Now, high cholesterol is also a major risk factor for dementia. So you're not just going to be improving your risk profile for cardiovascular disease, which is the leading cause of death in our country, but also for dementia, you know, and so there are huge benefits on offer just by making those changes, as you say.
Mm-hmm.
And really, when I get asked this question, usually someone also says, well, what animal products should I leave in the diet? And that's a good question. And even though I don't eat those products, I will speak to the science, because I think that's important information for people to have. And my answer to that is, to where you are having animal products, ideally it's lean meat.
Yep.
You know, be it red or white meat, it's lean cuts. And ideally from animals that are fed their native diet. I think that is going to lead to a high quality product. And it's also better for the animals through the duration of their life. Fatty fish, small sort of fatty fish that are lower on the food chain, salmon and sardines and mackerel, etc. And the other one that I often suggest, and I think this has actually very good planetary health benefits, is bivalves. So oysters, right, and scallops and clams,
right, you know,
foods like that. So to round that out, there are enormous benefits. Even if you're going to that sort of two-third plant-based diet, mm-hmm, you will lower your risk of these major chronic diseases, and you will feel better for it. You'll feel better for it in your day-to-day.
Yeah, well, in the end of the day, that's what we're all chasing, isn't it? And I mean, we've touched on a lot of the, I guess you could say, misconceptions to this point, but, and without giving away all your secrets, mate, is there any kind of misconceptions that really stick out to you that you kind of get asked very frequently that you think the listeners could benefit from of having a better understanding? We don't need to go into huge detail, but I guess some of the things that come up quite often for you, whether it's in the DMs or with people in person around eating a plant-based diet.
Yeah, there's a few. So if we continue on with the protein, probably the next question on that is around absorption and bioavailability.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an idea out there that animal protein is much more bioavailable. Now, I would argue that what matters most is the outcome. So like that study I explained earlier that showed that the strength and the hypertrophy was the same. I would argue that matters more than any other study that's looked at bioavailability. However, what's important to understand from a bioavailability point of view, and I'll keep this really short, is that historically we have had science showing that animal protein has much better bioavailability. This was from studies using animal models, rats and pigs.
Mm-hmm.
And the most important thing to understand here is in these animal models, they're feeding the animal's raw plant protein almost always. And so you can imagine if you were to try and eat a dried bean, I don't recommend it.
Yeah, it's not on the menu.
We know that when you properly prepare particularly plant foods and cook them, for example, beans, the nutrients become more bioavailable. So it's really not a great scientific experiment to try and work out what's the difference in bioavailability in humans. And human studies now have looked at this, and they're showing that the difference is probably only a few percent.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was speaking about health outcomes earlier mattering more, that's probably clinically insignificant. So I think that's something that's worth covering. The next is soy. Often am asked about soy.
Yeah.
And particularly whether males should be concerned about soy.
Mm-hmm.
And the phrase that comes up quite often is man boobs.
Yeah.
And so I've spent a lot of time going through the research on this. And again, I came at this from the point of view of, hey, if there's science there showing that soy consumption is going to be detrimental to my hormones, I want to know, because I will steer clear of it.
Yeah, for sure.
And so this speaks to an important principle, and that is that not all science is equal, and there is an evidence hierarchy, and we can use that to sort of grade different levels of science. And online, when I was going through this, I wanted to understand where someone who is suggesting that soy is harmful, I want to understand where they're basing that opinion from. What is it from? What's the evidence? And I found two main sources of evidence where this was coming from. The first is from my studies. And so there are my studies showing that when with large amounts of soy consumption, male mice have changes in hormones and have side effects. And so there's two things that we need to then consider here. One is, what's the exposure level? Exposure level is something that, particularly on social media, is never discussed. But in nutrition science, is absolutely critical, because if we're talking about any food, no matter what it is, to answer, is it healthy or is it harmful, we have to understand how much are we talking about? And are we talking about once a day, twice a day, three times a day, once a week? We have to understand consumption habits. And so in these animal studies, if you go into them, they are consuming soy at a level that we would never consume. It would be impossible for us to consume in a day. So the exposure is not comparable to what we would be exposed to if you're looking at grams of soy per kilogram of body mass.
Yeah.
So those studies have a problem. They're interesting and they're sort of hypothesis generating. And it's enough, if there was no other science, it's probably enough for some people to go, I'm going to take the precautionary approach and steer clear of soy. That's one source of where soy confusion is coming from. The second is there is a case study that was published by a doctor who had a patient, and it was a young, healthy male adult patient who suffered from what's called gynecomastia. And gynecomastia is sort of enlargement of breast tissue in a male. Yeah. Can actually occur in a female as well. But this on probing this gentleman about his history, it became clear that he was consuming 3 liters of soy milk a day. And so the case study was written up, and of course it's been cited thousands of times now, and it's shared, you know, pervasively online. But again, we have to come back to exposure. I'm almost certain if you had 3 liters of dairy every day or 3 liters of a lot of things every day, there could be problems.
I would say so.
And so, again, if that was all of the evidence, I would get it, enough to be sort of cautious about. But it's not. We have human studies. We have what's called a meta-analysis, which last year combined the results of 38 different clinical trials. So this is the top line evidence. It's clinical trial interventions with humans, not with animals. Let's feed them soy products and let's look at their estrogen levels. Let's look at their free testosterone, total testosterone, and let's see, does this food affect hormones when we're looking at consumption levels that would take place in society? Mm-hmm. And they found absolutely not. There was no changes in hormone levels. These studies range from 6 weeks all the way up to 52 weeks. So long enough to where you would expect to see something. So my advice to people listening and to really anyone I speak to is that you don't need to fear soy. But like all foods, I don't think you need to go overboard on it either. And so,
yeah.
You know, traditional communities consuming soy probably consume about 1 or 2 serves a day. And so in line with that appears perfectly fine. And equally, if for some reason you don't want to consume soy or you're allergic, then, you know, by all means, it's also not necessary. So it's everyone has their own choice there.
Unreal, man. Look, we've kind of just started to touch the sides today. I reckon we could keep going for a long time. We'll definitely have to do a part two. I just want to quickly touch on, before I wrap up, the book, man. How was the process of putting it together? How's the response been? And obviously I'll have the link in the show notes, but where can the listeners access the book so they can continue to learn, for those that have been interested in today's episode?
Yeah, thanks, mate. So the book's called The Proof is in the Plants, and probably the best place to go is plantproof.com/book. From there, you can see a link to all retailers. Mm-hmm. It's in bookstores across Australia and all the major online bookstores. So if you want to grab a copy, you can find it there. How was the process? Took 3 and a bit years. So it's nice to see it out there now. And
yeah,
I'm really pleased with the traction. So it's nice to see that the community, far beyond my own personal reach, is really interested in this information. So yeah, it's going well.
Fantastic, mate. Well, Simon, a huge thank you for joining me on the show today, man. I'd love to catch up in person when we can, and we'll definitely do a part two. It's been really informative. I've taken a lot away from it, and like I said, we could go on for hours, and I'm sure we will at some point. But a big thank you to you, man. I'll have the links to, as I mentioned, the book and the socials and everything in the show notes below. If there's anything else you want to mention, jump in, man. Otherwise, again, thanks for joining us.
Probably just one thing I'll mention there about the book is 100% of the proceeds that I receive from Penguin are being donated. So your purchase will go towards protecting the daintree rainforest in Australia from deforestation. So each book sold, we've calculated, will save 2 square meters. So yeah, if you buy the book, hopefully good for your health, but also good for our country as well.
Incredible, man. Good on you. Again, man, thanks a lot. And for everyone who's tuned into the episode, a big thank you for listening today. We hope you've taken away a lot of value, which I'm sure you have. If you've enjoyed the episode, please do take a screenshot on your phone right now. Post it up on your Instagram story for us. Tag myself, tag Simon. Again, I'll have the links to his socials in the show notes. Big thanks, guys. Thanks for tuning in. Again, thanks, Simon.
Thanks, mate.